Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culloden.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Culloden and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, drill, baby drill, we ask, are oil and gas companies pivoting back to fossil fuels? How much attention are shoppers paying to food labels? We look at the economics and what's on the other side of the packet. Plus, David M. Walker is a former Comptroller General of the US and he talks about the current state of economics with me. Now, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on LinkedIn, Instagram, Blue Sky, and X at Susan Hayes Culloden. Now, I want to start off today by picking up on a line I spotted in the summer economic statement. Now, that's a document that the government releases to tell us about the financial state of the country and give us a heads up on what's coming in the budget. So in there, and I quote, is a line that says, "The public finances are not as healthy as headline figures suggest. While the headline budgetary position is in a surplus, this is almost entirely due to a handful of large corporate taxpayers." Now, listeners of Taking Stock will be well aware of this, as I discuss this regularly with our guests, but I do want to explain the term surplus. It means that the government is taking in more in tax than it is spending now, and that is what's leading them to be planning a budgetary package of round about 9.4 billion, as we heard in the summer economic statement. Now, the opposite of a surplus is a deficit, which is what many of us may remember well into the 2010s, and that's why we're spending more than we're taking in on tax. The reason I'm bringing this up with you today is there is likely to be a lot of talk around this and how much of a surplus the government will have when it comes to budget day based on tariffs, etc., will affect how much you have in your income after the budget. So that's why I wanted to talk to you about it on this bright and beautiful day. Okay. Well, we have an Irishman appointed chair of one of the biggest companies in the world, Albert Manifold, formerly of CRH, is the new chair of BP. And that got me thinking about where the oil industry is today and where it's going tomorrow. So I'm delighted to be joined now by Jamie Smith, the US energy editor with the Financial Times. Jamie, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hello, Susan. Hi.
Now, I am going to start off, Jamie, by looking at the oil industry broadly. So the US pumps more than 13 million barrels a day, the most the US has ever produced, primarily from shale oil. Chevron has reduced its capital spending in 2025. ConocoPhillips is planning to reduce its spending by half a billion, yet Trump's wants them to drill, baby, drill. So how is the price of oil sitting in between these conflicting objectives?
Yeah, it's almost impossible to do both. So I think if you look across Trump's policy agenda, there's contradictions riddled throughout them. And this is one of the big ones. You know, all during the campaign trail, he said, you know, if you elect me, I'm going to drill, baby, drill. We're going to have this new era of American energy dominance. But when he came into office, you know, his tariff policy in particular spooked markets. And we had a weak economy in China, and that sent the oil price down sharply. And what effect that has is that the shale drillers, which are really at the center of the American oil revolution in the last 20 years, you know, they've started to drop drilling rigs. They've started to wind down some of their activity. And that means that we're expecting U.S. oil production it's now plateauing, and we expect it could peak this year and start to reduce next year. So in a way, it's completely the opposite of what Trump said he wanted. But you have to remember, Trump also said he wanted to slash energy prices. And that, I think, is a more important goal for his administration. Inflation, he needs to get inflation under control because that was such a key part of the election victory. And low gasoline prices, in particular in the US, are a really important thing for him to achieve.
But basic economics would tell us that if you increase the supply dramatically, it may lead to a price decrease. And the people he's asking to increase the supply are the people who make money out of what they're taking out of the ground. So we can see where that conflict would arise. But if we just dial in there a little bit to Trump's actions, he's declared an energy emergency. He removed electric vehicle subsidies and favourable regulations for the green energy industry, and lifted Biden's ban on offshore drilling leases. So I'm not asking where the oil industry is going in the US, but I am asking, where do you feel the energy industry broadly is going in the US?
Yeah, we're at a really interesting period in US history in terms of energy. So what you're seeing is that after two decades of flat electricity demand in the US, you're seeing this incredible spike in electricity demand, mainly because of artificial intelligence data centers, the electrification of transport, EVs, and actually a lot of investments in industry in the US. So you're seeing this really large increase in electricity demand. And that is one of the spurs for Trump to announce this energy emergency. Now, the way he's trying to tackle that, there's a lot of debate about whether it's counterproductive. So, for example, you've seen this one big, beautiful bill that was just passed into law here. And what that will do is it really sharply cuts subsidies to EVs, wind power, solar power. And, you know, there's a pivot away from renewables. And that is, I think, going to cause significant challenges in the next couple of years here, because renewables are actually, in many ways, the cheapest and the quickest type of energy to deploy on grids. And they need a lot of electricity. And if you slow down that renewable rollout, then you could push prices up higher. And prices are already rising in the electricity sector ahead of inflation. And this week, actually, we had a big auction here for power capacity in the biggest grid area of the United States, and that was at a record price level. So all the indicators are that if you slash renewables, you pivot away from the energy transition, actually you'll push prices up, which is certainly not what he wants to achieve. On the oil and gas side, you know, he's very strongly in support of these industries, and while the price of oil and gas has fallen, he has removed a lot of the barriers for them to drill for oil, particularly with these lease sales in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, he's allowing those again. We're going to have some more of them. And he's taking away a lot of the green regulations that the Biden administration put ahead. So in the short term, Trump has, you know, helped to bring down the price of oil, which is not great for the oil industry. But over the longer term, they're hopeful that by getting rid of these regulations, they'll be able to drill more and boost production in the future. And of course, that remains to be seen.
But yeah, what's the point in boosting production of something that's unprofitable?
Well, they you see, this is the big debate, because, you know, the oil and gas industry, you know, says, oh, actually, demand is strong and it's going to come back and we will get good prices in the future. And they point to the fact that every year, you know, the resource base gets depleted. So you have to keep investing to keep it going. So they would argue that high oil prices are going to come back. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, critics and many economists suggest, well, actually, no, the oil price isn't going to, you know, rush back to the $100 levels or the $90 levels, which we saw, you know, recently. And this new era is going to be, you know, at much lower prices, you know, the $60 to $70 level that we're seeing at the minute.
But our conversation so far has kept very much domestically in the US. And I want to bring the conversation across the Atlantic in a moment. But before I do, I want to go the other direction, and that's China. When we look at the green energy transition in terms of dollars or renminbi invested, China is running away with it. They're investing more than the US, than the UK, than the EU put together. So is it the case that the conversation that we've just had is, relatively speaking, a little bit of a vacuum, because that might be the case based on American domestic demand? But if China can bring the technology and the capacity to develop and deploy green energy at so much greater scale and at lower cost, could that fundamentally be the alternative that could change the long-term direction of oil prices and demand in general and supply?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're already seeing that China has, you know, particularly its EV penetration. A lot of, you know, the electric vehicle rollout in China is massive. And that is already hitting its oil demand there. And, you know, oil demand is peaking in China because of that. So in that way, you know, China is going to have an influential role in the global oil market. On another point, you know, China is really racing ahead in electric vehicles, solar technologies, battery storage in particular. It's really dominating those industries. And the Biden administration set out to challenge that because of geopolitical, geopolitical reasons. It didn't want China to race ahead. So it offered these, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of incentives to try and to build this industry in the US. The Trump administration's come in and made massive changes to that and removed a lot of subsidies. So I would say we're facing a future where China really will gain a lead in those industries of the future, whereas the US is going to face at least, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years of a slowdown there. And I just don't know if it's going to be able to catch up.
And this is the thing. I mean, the Draghi report highlights the same issue in Europe as well, is that if China is running away with this and winning the AI race as well, both superpowers in the world, namely the EU and the US, need to really figure out where its USP, where its unique selling point is going to come from. But as I said, I want to bring the conversation across the Atlantic now. And as I mentioned at the beginning, Albert Manifold, previous CEO of the Irish company CRH, has now been appointed as chair of BP. Word on the street, Jamie, is that they need somebody to lead the board, the strategy and help in terms of performance management of the business. It has heavy debts. Investors haven't shown a confidence in its strategy. And Bloomberg describes it as a thankless job that nobody wants. What do you think Albert Manifold is facing?
It's a very, very difficult job, to be fair, because BP's been in crisis for probably the last 15 years. You know, it had, I think it really all started with the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, you know, 15 years ago. That has cost the company $70 billion in fines and cleanup costs. It, you know, 11 people died in that. It really dented the company to a huge extent. And then, you know, you've had several other issues over the last decade. You know, you think like BP made a big play into Russia, taking a 20% stake in Rosneft. And then after the Ukraine war, it had to walk away from that. You know, that cost $25 billion. You had Bernard Looney, another Irishman, who was leading the company. And he pivoted BP, you know, away from its oil and gas base, much more towards the energy transition and renewables. And that, after the Ukraine war, that strategy, you know, fell apart basically because oil and gas spiked so high. You know, it just became much more profitable. So investors lost faith in the strategy. Bernard Looney had to resign over a separate issue, you know, to do with relationships with the company. So it's been a really, really difficult time. And, you know, what Manifold faces is a major activist hedge fund, Elliott Management, in which has taken a 5% stake in BP, and it's really calling for severe changes in its strategy. But, you know, Manifold, you know, he came into the FT office here in New York a couple of years ago. I met him. You know, he's really smart, shrewd guy. He's not really one for grabbing the limelight, but he has a very good track record at CRH. You know, he really turned that company around, built it up, and really his focus on shareholder returns was what attracted BP's headhunters when they were looking for a new chairman. So I think, you know, he has an opportunity, but it's going to be a very difficult job for sure.
You know, and maybe he relishes a challenge. Maybe that's part of the allure here. But I do want to look more into that move that BP has made away from renewables and back towards its core. And I want to ask you about that. Is that a BP thing, or is that an indication of the industry? Like, just to give listeners a bit more context on this. So the company has decided to strategically move away from renewables, but back toward, and as it's doing that, sell the entire US onshore wind business, dramatically cutting its capital investment in its renewable and low carbon ventures, stopped the pursuit of new offshore wind projects, trimmed its electric vehicle charging ambition, and also potentially divesting up to $20 billion of a portfolio as well. Is this just because BP has had all the issues that you've mentioned, its core and the way in which it delivers value is oil and gas, or is this something that is more indicative of where the industry is going?
You know, I think it's you know, I'm mainly covering the US companies, Exxon and Chevron, and there's a huge difference between the investor base in you know, European majors like BP and Shell and American majors like Exxon and Chevron. And, you know, in Europe, there is much more of a commitment to the energy transition and to tackling climate change than what we see at the minute in the US. So, and that goes to investors as well. You know, I mean, you have in the US big investors who actually try to promote climate targets, you know, will be attacked politically here. So you just got this completely different context. Whereas in Europe, you know, Legal & General, for example, a shareholder at BP, you know, it's concerned about BP ditching its sort of energy transition policy. So that context is really important to consider. Now, BP has actually, you know, over the last 25 years, has flirted with this idea of the energy transition. 2000, it had the Beyond Petroleum rebrand. And now everyone jokes that this new rebrand, which was brought out in February, is the Back to Petroleum rebrand, you know, and in a sense it is, you know, because...
But if we look at this though, and I'll finish on this, where we look at this from an investing point of view, like the share price peaked 20 years ago. You mentioned it's been having a lot of trouble for the past 15. Is the stock potentially undervalued at this point? Like, it's got five great businesses. You have the deep water oil operations in the Gulf of Mexico. You have the US shale arm, BPX. You have the oil and gas businesses in Abu Dhabi and Azerbaijan. And then you have the company's liquefied natural gas assets. Now, admittedly, everything else is probably costing them rather than anything else. But when you look at that, I mean, is this an opportunity for investors at this point?
Well, I think whenever you see an activist hedge fund like Elliott getting involved in a company, then it certainly suggests it could well be a great opportunity if the company can pull itself out of its slump, you know? So, yes, BP has some great assets. Its trading arm is very good as well, you know, as the assets you've also mentioned. So I think there are opportunities if it can get its house in order and tackle its high debt level. I think one of the challenges that Manifold will face, you know, is actually just changing the mood amongst employees. It's been a very bruising time, you know, for people at BP.
And, you know, 15 or 20 years is a long time to be bruised. Well, I'll tell you, we wish Albert Manifold the very best in his new position, that is for sure. And we'll be watching this, not just BP, but the broader industry. And as you say, the conflicts that's among them as well, whether it's between different geographies or between different intentions politically and economically. So thank you so much indeed, Jamie Smith, the US Energy Editor with the Financial Times, for joining me today.
Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at the economics of food labels. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Now, I want to share some comments with you from last week. And first up, I have Sheila, who's a listener to the show via podcast in London. And she said in response to the piece last week about the impact of climate change on insurability, she said, I live in a grade 2 listed 500-year-old thatched property. And because I have a wood burner, my insurance has risen exponentially. My chimney is lined. I have a certificate from an approved chimney sweep every 6 months, but still the cost goes up annually. Many insurance companies simply refuse to insure thatched properties because of the wood burner. And this really just ties into the fact of how you might buy a house and have a mortgage for decades, but you can only insure your house year on year. And if that changes, or the availability of that insurance changes, how then that can affect the asset price of your house as well. The second thing I want to share with you from last week is actually from Polita Clark herself, who I interviewed about the topic, because she followed up with me to tell me that a few of you have reached out to her afterwards about our conversation. So I was delighted to hear that. Now, as public health concerns around diet-related illnesses grow, clear and effective labelling have become an important tool in helping consumers make more informed choices. But just how effective is food labelling when it comes to swaying purchasing habits, and what improvements might help them make them even more effective? So we're joined now by Eoin Scally from Scally's Super Value in Clonakilty and Sarah Keogh, dietitian and founder of Eat Well. Eoin and Sarah, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Great, good to be here.
Thanks very much, Susan.
Okay, Eoin, we'll start with you. 63% of Irish consumers, according to the Irish Examiner, rank cost as their top consideration. But how important do you think nutritional labelling is when it comes to stocking or promoting certain products in your shop?
It's absolutely vital, Susan. And I suppose, obviously, cost is a huge factor for everybody, given the times, I suppose, that we live in. But what I suppose I've seen recently, particularly over the last number of months in the store, is that people are paying an awful lot more attention to the labels on their products. They're looking at them, they're analysing them, they're asking questions, which I think is fantastic to see, because as somebody who's working in the retail sector, but also has a medical background, I think it's great that people are being more, I suppose, proactive about what they're eating, what they're looking to get the information about what they're putting into their bodies. And it's great. And I suppose as a parent of a young child with food allergies, we've always been looking at the labels on products. But as I said, over the last couple of months, it's become more and more noticeable that people are, they're shopping, they're taking out their phones, they're Googling, they're researching, and it's great to see it. And I suppose there are some social media influencers who have become really, I suppose, really to the fore over the last couple of months. And it's definitely kind of showing through in what we're seeing on the retail floor, that people are paying attention, they are watching, they are looking, they are taking it in. And I suppose from our perspective, I suppose as retailers and as being on the shop floor, it's great, because I suppose I felt myself personally that people aren't exactly fully up to speed on where their food is coming from, what's in it. Even something as simple as seasonal product, like down in Clonakilty, we'd be very much strong supporters of our local producers, our local farmers, and really have a strong history of supporting local. And I suppose we know the seasons. We know when the potatoes are coming in. We know when the root veg is ready to harvest. But for a lot of people, they're so used to having product 12 months of the year, such with, say, strawberries being one example, that just that seasonality is completely gone out of people's understanding. Mm-hmm. So I suppose I just think it's great to see people being aware and educating themselves, and I suppose being educated by different people, be it online or in other forums, which is great.
Right. Well, Sarah, picking up there on the points that Owen made, particularly about, say, social media influencers, and obviously the fact that people want to put good things into their body, it does make good good health sense, is what I mean to say. The ASRI found that when products displayed the Nutri-Score label, and this is another big and healthy alternatives were available, consumers on average chose healthier food. So in your experience, how well do consumers understand the information presented on food labels?
My experience is that they really don't. And apart from being a dietitian, I have a master's in European food regulation. And I actually did my master's specifically on how people understand, or to be more accurately, don't understand what's on the label. And what I know from research I've done and research since, even on things like Nutri-Score, that what people tend to do, like there's a huge amount about the food on the label. You know, you look at the whole ingredient list, you look at the nutrition table, there might be, you know, what we call GDAs on the front of it, or front of pack labeling. There might be other claims, something might say high protein, you know, low carb, all of these different things. Most people can't, you know, have the time to really pull every single bit of that information together to make a choice about a food. But the thing is, they often don't need to. And that's where something like Nutri-Score does come in. And Nutri-Score is really interesting because it doesn't just look at often what we call maybe the nutrients we want to limit, like saturated fat or salt. It also looks at what's positive in the food. So it would look at things like the protein, the amount of fruit and veg in it. So it gives a score with it. And, you know, as scoring systems go, it's pretty good. There's nothing going to be 100%. So they can be helpful. What I find is it's great. I love to see people looking at food on labels. But as Owen said, I mean, stuff like your fruit and veg isn't going to sort of have nutrition labels. We already know that's good for us. You know, your fresh meat, your fish, you know, all of those things, they're all going to be fine. It's really when we get into foods that have, you know, a lot more things mixed up together. You might be buying a ready meal. You might be buying, you know, maybe tins of tomatoes with herbs in them and stuff like that. You know, you can have a look and maybe compare things like salt and so on. I think it is very difficult for people to actually pull all of that information together. So scoring systems like Nutri-Score can be helpful. But I would say to people, you know, even if you're following someone on social media who's looking at labeling, go in and have a look yourself as well. You know, because, you know, it's really important that you're understanding what's going on and not always necessarily just going with somebody else might say.
Right, Owen. Let's just look at that though, because as Sarah said there, there's a big difference between the fruit and veg, the fresh meat, etc., and then the other, I suppose, the ready meals, etc. Because I found in research published by the Journal of Public Health Nutrition, 54.9% of the Irish diet is ultra-processed foods. Have you noticed any changes in customer behaviour or purchasing trends in response to nutrition labels like low-fat or high-protein or traffic light systems? I mean, if we are eating an awful lot more of this, are we taking notice of that specifically?
It's interesting that you ask it, Susan. I suppose a couple of years back when I came into the retail sector, the big trend at that stage was vegan and vegetarian and flexitarian and all this kind of, I suppose, plant-based eating. And I suppose what we found, and I can only speak to my own store, is that it never really took off in a massive way. Now, I don't know if where we're based in Clonakilty, and as I said, we have so many local producers, maybe things are done differently. There seems to be an awful lot of cooking from scratch done by a lot of the people that shop with us. But of all, we say that the food trends that have come out over the last number of years, protein is definitely the one that we're seeing having an impact. That like people are looking for high protein breads, they're looking for high protein cottage cheeses, high protein. It seems to be all about the protein at the moment. But I suppose in terms of all the other ones, that's really the only one that seems to be coming through, which is I suppose it's interesting, and I'm not exactly sure what's fueling it, I suppose, in the background, but that's really the trend that seems to be coming to the front.
Well, let's ask the lady behind the dietitians of the country that very question, because, Sarah, nearly half of consumers look for specifics based on the research that I did, the specifics like calories or sugar or salt content. But when it comes to things like protein, as Owen has said there, are there misconceptions about this as well? If I find something with high protein, is it better than something without? Labelled as high protein?
And it's one of those things, it depends. And I know as a dietitian, when I say that to people, they nearly roll their eyes. And I'm going to go back to something that Owen said there, which is really important. Trends like vegan, vegetarian, I do a lot of work in consultancy with companies. And at the time that was the big trend, I was advising companies not to invest hugely in vegan or vegetarian. Not because there's any reason not to, but it was a trend that, it was the most talked about trend that nobody was following. Now, you had people who were vegan by choice for a very long time, but that idea where everybody was going to go vegetarian, it really never took off. And I definitely, it's interesting to see Owen saying that as well. The reason protein is taking off is because there's actually very good science behind it. Unlike most of your trends that come and go, we know that protein, now we don't, I will say this, most people don't need as much as they're going for at the moment. And I know when I'm dealing with individuals, I'm often reducing the amount of protein they're eating because they're way overshooting it. But it is a very important nutrient. And we know for older people as well, in terms of maintaining muscle and bone, and you know, there's a huge amount for it. But I think your point there is very important, that people tend to focus in on one nutrient at a time. Mm. And this is because reading labels is so complex and assessing that huge amount of information. But what you have to remember is it follows trends. In the late 90s, when the big trend was fat-free, people looked at fat on labels. You know, 10 years ago when sugar took off, everyone was just looking at sugar on labels. Today, everyone is looking at protein. So it's the trend follows. Now, the protein one is going to stay. But I think just because something says high protein on it, it doesn't automatically mean it's good for you. And sometimes when you have those labels on the front of a pack, we call them giving the product a health halo. So it gives us this halo of being healthy, even though there might be other things in there that are not. So, you know, the front of pack, oh, high protein, you can go, oh, that must be good for me. I'd still have a quick look around the back and, you know, maybe check out things. Particularly the two I'd look at are saturated fat and salt. I'd be keeping a good close eye on those two.
Okay, saturated salt and fat. Okay. And Owen, a University of Galway study recently highlighted that 78% of customers trust the nutrition and health claims on food labels. Now, while I'm certainly not suggesting that they shouldn't believe them, I am wondering though, can we place the weight that people have on labels? Or do you find that on the shop floor that people ask for clarification about nutritional information on packaging?
With regards to the labelling element of it, Susan, I just don't think people understand it. Like, I think there, as Sarah was kind of mentioning earlier on, that there's so much information there. And I think really the vast majority of people don't, I suppose they can't translate that into something that they can understand. Like there's, you know, so many grams per 100 grams and how many grams is that in the portion and portion sizes. And it's very difficult to really understand what you're getting. So I think like probably a lot of it comes back to education.
Sorry to cut across to their own. It's just interesting, Sarah, that you have two ways of looking at it, which is saturated fat and salt. I used to be in Weight Watchers years and years ago, and I found it was a great education for a start, and everything was measured in terms of calories and saturation fat, saturated fat. And therefore that gave me a really clear mechanism. As I'm listening to you both saying there's an awful lot of information, etc., I don't feel like that because I know the two things that I would look out for. Now, whether they're the right things or not, or whether my education is out of date. So I'm wondering if from that perspective, what, Sarah, and sorry, one other point. The Food Safety Authority of Ireland found that 2/3 of consumers reported reading food labels, but women far more likely to do so than men. So what needs to change from the perspective of the food industry or the packaging industry or regulation in order to help this apart from education?
Well, I would look at a couple of things. And it's interesting you were saying that I think the Food Safety Authority found that quite a high percentage of people are reading labels. And I know in my own research, I found that. But my research, I went on to actually quiz them on what they understood from it. And although in my study, 46% of people said they read the nutrition label, fewer than 2% of them could actually confidently answer any questions about it. So they were reading it, they were taking information. And it was interesting, I presented this at a Cork University a few years ago, and I said, you know, 7% of people, when I asked them why they read the nutrition label, looked at me and said, I actually don't know. That they feel like they're just looking at it. And I think it's that overwhelming thing. What I would actually say to you, I mean, there's actually been huge work done on improving labeling. So, you know, there was laws passed to increase the font size so it was easier for people to read. There was changes in how it was presented. Like, this is actually at EU level really looked at. I don't know how you'd actually pull it all together. Nutri-Score might be one way to do it, but like any scoring system, it's not perfect. It's very good, but there's always going to be issues with it. I would come back to something very simple, is we talk about healthy eating. And, you know, when I say the words healthy eating, people nearly go asleep, like, oh, here we go, healthy eating. But healthy eating is quite basic. Plenty, you know, you're 5 a day with your fruit and veg, you're getting your low-fat dairy and your yogurt, you know, your things like that for your calcium, you're getting your protein in. When we start looking at packaged foods, and particularly, you know, the big scary term ultra-processed food is out there at the moment. And what that ultra-processed food and all the studies showing that it might be bad for you, they're really looking at what we would have called, you know, 10 years ago, treat foods. So your biscuits, cakes, pastries, crisps, foods we recognise as treats as part of a healthy diet, but not something to eat a huge amount of. And they get a label of ultra-processed foods, but there's other foods in the ultra-processed category that are actually very healthy. So some of your whole grain bread would be technically classified as an ultra-processed food, but we know people eating this whole grain bread get less bowel cancer. You know, things like some yogurts would be classified as ultra-processed, and yet we see an association with a reduced risk of colon cancer. So the idea that something that's ultra-processed is automatically bad is something we also need to talk about. And I think rather than we've gone round and round with labelling, maybe we'd look at something like nutrient profiling, but I think it's that nuts and bolts education. You know, when you look at your plate, is there fruit and veg on your plate? Have you got some protein on there? Have you got some whole grains? And you'll actually be 80% of the way there. And if you happen to have a biscuit or a bit of chocolate with it, enjoy it.
Well, on that note, I'm off to do that very thing. So that's great practical advice there that I wanted to finish up on. So thanks, Sarah, for getting there ahead of me. Owen, I would have loved to have talked to you about grocery inflation and all of those things that a lot of us are talking about as well at the moment, but time doesn't allow us to do that. I'm going to thank you both very much. Owen Scally from Scally's Super Value in Clonakilty and Sarah Keogh, dietitian and founder of Eat Well.
Brilliant. Thanks very much.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we talk to David M. Walker, who was the man in charge of American finances under Bill Clinton and George Bush. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. So the US now has $36 trillion of debt, and the big, beautiful tax bill is going to add to that considerably over the coming years. However, one man who has strong views on how the deficit should be dealt with and feels that that is actually only the tip of the iceberg is my next guest. David M. Walker is the former Comptroller General in the US government and author of America in 2040. He joins me now from Alexandria, Virginia in the US. Hello, David. You're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Good to be with you, Susan. I love Ireland.
Oh, that's good to hear. We're off to a great start. Well, I was in Ohio recently, David, and I bought your previous book about the fiscal position of the US. And when I started reading your most recent one, America in 2040, the theme was broadly similar, that the world is missing the point that while we're focusing on the debt deficit and interest currently, the challenge that the US faces is actually much greater, with total federal liabilities and unfunded social insurance obligations exceeding $125 trillion, which dwarfs the number that I mentioned in my introduction. And that number is growing far faster than the economy. So what's your take on what's really going on?
Well, politicians like to talk about positive numbers, but they don't like to talk about negative numbers. And now we're at about $37 trillion in debt. But as you mentioned, that doesn't count unfunded civilian and military pensions, retiree health care, unfunded social insurance obligations. You know, our debt as a percentage of the economy is too high now. It's projected to get a lot higher. And the problem is, as you touched on, the recent One Big Beautiful Bill Act, while it may help economic growth in the short term, it makes our long-range fiscal imbalance worse. And so we need to start making some tough choices on spending and revenues in order to regain fiscal sanity and sustainability.
Fiscal sanity. Now, I've often heard of fiscal sustainability, but fiscal sanity is a whole other ballgame. One of the things that's often quoted, including by myself, is that interest now is the interest that the US government now has to pay is actually greater than that of defence spending. And as you mentioned as well in many of your writings, the books and otherwise, interest represents the fastest growing cost in the federal budget. Now, you serve on the Defence Business Board, and that gives advice to the Secretary of Defence today. And we are seeing a dramatic rise in spending in defence in the US, in Germany, right around the world. So what are you discussing now at board meetings currently?
Well, right now, the board has been suspended and they've got to reappoint members. I hope and expect that I will be reappointed. But look, our Defense Department for the next fiscal year will have over $1 trillion in its budget, but interest will still exceed that. Obviously, national security is a fundamental responsibility of the federal government under our Constitution. But that doesn't mean that there's not waste in the Pentagon's budget. There's plenty of waste. And one of the things that we have to do is to really take a hard look at what are we doing based upon current and future threats, rather than trying to perpetuate things that have existed based upon past threats.
But what does national security mean today? Because is it from a military point of view? Is it, I'm sure it includes a cybersecurity point of view. I mean, national security now, though, I would imagine extends beyond that. And it's not just elements of war, is it?
No, it's economic security, it's homeland security, it's national security, it's economic power, it's international influence, it's protecting your borders, it's dealing with terrorist organizations and criminal organizations. I mean, it's broadly defined, and it's one that we can't just do by ourselves. We need to do it in partnership with our allies.
And I want to get on to that for sure. But before I do, I want to just go back to your point there about the waste in the Pentagon. I mean, obviously, Doge and Elon Musk and the attempts there all got a lot of drama and dramatic headlines. But the objective of trying to slim down waste across the federal system, was the intent right while the approach may be questionable?
My view is that what Doge did is not what needs to be done. What needs to be done is to be able to take a comprehensive look at the federal government, compare it to what our founders intended for it to do, then take a look at the authorizing legislation for the various departments and agencies. What are they doing versus what they're supposed to be doing? In both of those cases, there are big gaps. Thirdly, to be able to come up with a strategic plan that says, what are we trying to accomplish and how do we measure success in outcome-based terms? We still don't have one of those, so that we're then in a position to be able to make much more informed decisions about what the government should do, how it should do it, at what level it should be done, who should do it. And that would end up generating, frankly, a lot more savings and a lot increased effectiveness as compared to what Doge did.
But the thing about what you're saying there, David, is that sounds like basic, that is exactly what should be done for a start. But why hasn't that been done all along? I mean, you were at the heart of government as over several decades. What was holding that back?
Well, in fairness, when I was the Comptroller General of the United States, which is really Auditor General, Chief Accountability Office of the United States, I did that at the Government Accountability Office. The Government Accountability Office had been in existence since 1921. I came there in 1998. And so we implemented that when I was there. The U.S. government's been around since 1789. I would say you don't necessarily want to rush into things, but I think we've had enough time and it should have been done a long time ago. Again, that's the kind of thing that I think we need to be doing, which is a much more dramatic action than Doge was talking about. And then plus Doge didn't realize that they can't cut spending. Only Congress can cut spending. And therefore, they overpromised and underdelivered, and it's time that we go for much bigger transformational reform.
Do you see that happening?
I think this administration would like to see that happen. I'm really surprised and disappointed that the Defense Department hasn't stood up the Defense Business Board yet, because the Defense Business Board could be a significant partner in trying to make that happen. But it's not just what you do; it's how you do it that matters. And unfortunately, in some cases, the administration has the right idea about what needs to be done, but they haven't gone about it the right way. And another example of that is hiring freezes and reductions in force. I mean, those need to be made based upon the needs of the country, the mission of the agency, and the skills, knowledge, and performance of the individuals. And the ones that have been done so far have not been consistent with that principle.
Okay. Well, let's look at the size, though, of the federal government, because in the book, where you start off by painting a picture of what America could look like in 2040 on its current trajectory, you were saying the federal government has grown from 2% of the US economy in 1912 to about 21% in 2019 to more than 28% and growing in 2040. And if that number wasn't striking enough, what was particularly remarkable in my case, I felt, was when you said, when you add state and local spending, government has grown to more than 40% of the US economy and the nonprofit sector has grown significantly. David, the US has established itself as the home of entrepreneurship and capitalism. Like, has it been melting away?
Well, the engine of growth and innovation in the United States is the private sector. And, you know, to the extent that government grows bigger, it pulls resources out of the private sector, which is not in our long-term interest. And, you know, as I've said, government's grown too big, promised too much, subsidized too many, undercut states' rights, lost control of the budget, is operating, you know, without a plan and based on outdated management practices. Other than that, it's doing okay. But I would respectfully suggest that's not okay.
But when I look at the jobs numbers as well, when you look at the new jobs being added to the U.S. economy, and when you really dig into them, and when the market has a chance to dig into them as well, and then you're hearing about conversations that are happening a few hours after they're released, much of the job increases is happening at government level. It's not necessarily the private sector that is adding all those new jobs there, which of course then would lead somebody to question how sustainable the job increases are, particularly when many of the world's commentators are expecting tariffs to have a negative impact, and of course not just negative impact on price but negative impact on jobs too. So do you find that? Do you find that the US government is muddying the waters, you could say, of the employment and labor market in the US as well?
Well, you have to lift the hood, look underneath, and get the details with regard to the numbers. I mean, the two major sectors of our economy that have been growing are government and healthcare. And, you know, the current administration, the Trump administration, wants to reverse that at the federal level. But obviously, state and local governments are separate, distinct sovereign entities. They've got to end up making their own decisions in that regard. And there's no question that there's bloat at other levels of government that has to be addressed as well. But the biggest challenge is at the federal level.
Okay. And I want to now also move to the American household from the federal level to the American household, because when we talk about real interest rates, and real, of course, means inflation adjusted interest rates. For a start, the 10-year real treasury rate, or the level at which the US government borrows from an inflation adjusted perspective, is almost at 2%, and it's double the long term average. And of course, the amount of debt that the government is borrowing is increasing significantly. So when you look at why that might be, we could point to global debt levels increasing, geopolitical tensions, global trade fracturing, rising military expenditure. We could talk and talk and talk about this. But what impact does greater real interest rates have on the average American household?
Well, it's very difficult to buy a home. It's caused people who do have a home and have lower mortgage rates to stay in that home rather than potentially move or trying to upgrade their residence. It results in higher costs for all kinds of borrowing, whether it be for an automobile, or whether it be for appliances, or whether it be for just ongoing purchases. And it's a matter of concern. But I think the reason that the Federal Reserve has kept interest rates as high as they have, and that's a controversial topic, is because they want to see how the tariff situation plays out. It's in process. It's probably the biggest uncertainty that we have right now. The second thing is that they're concerned, and they've said it for many years, with regard to the unsustainable fiscal path that we're on. I mean, we're running deficits of about $2 trillion a year. But in addition to that $2 trillion a year, we have to refinance about $8 trillion worth of maturing debt. And a lot of that debt was issued at lower interest rates than the current market. And therefore, you end up having a compounding effect of not only having to pay interest on new debt, but having to pay a somewhat higher interest rate on maturing debt. That's, as we call it in the South, that's a double whammy.
Well, you know what makes me shake my head when I hear you say this is you're talking about a $2 trillion deficit, the sheer amount of debt that you're talking about as well, the maturing debt. And this is at a time of full employment after a significantly strong economic cycle in the US. We're not talking about a crisis here. We're not talking about a pandemic. We're not talking about just after the World War. This is a time when America has had it really, really good economically at a macro level. I know there's plenty of people who might challenge me on that from a micro level, but this is what, it just strikes me, like, where is the firepower in America to deal with an economic crisis? But I do want to ask you about the dollar, because you brought up there about a controversial topic relating to the Fed keeping interest rates high. But we're seeing major questioning of the independence of the Fed. We see China continuing to decouple from the dollar. We're seeing the growth of cryptocurrencies driven on by the current administration. And we're seeing the behaviour of the dollar resembling that more of an emerging market rather than a global reserve. What's your outlook for the dollar now?
Well, the dollar has declined significantly since the beginning of the year. Gold has gone up significantly since the beginning of the year. There's a lot of talk about cryptocurrencies. You know, candidly, in the United States, there's a lot more people that are concerned that Congress may not act before we have a debt crisis. And what would a debt crisis mean? It would mean a failed auction, not able to be able to sell all the debt that we need to sell at reasonable prices, which would have serious adverse economic, national security, domestic tranquility implications that not only would be felt in the United States, it'd be felt around the world. My personal view is the United States has been abusing its position as the world's leading reserve currency. We've got to put our finances in order. You can't become a superpower and stay a superpower unless you have economic strength, and you can't maintain economic strength if you can't put your finances in order.
Two pithy lines that are in the book. One is this: unlike China, the US is not very good at long-range thinking. This must change. And another line you have is that the US government can't cut, can't grow, or can't inflate its way out. So, David, what is the way to get out of this problem with the long-term thinking, like China or otherwise?
We need to do three things. First, we need to do that type of the type of comprehensive, strategic, and transformational review of what the government does, how it does it, at what level it does it, what's it trying to accomplish, how to measure success, which is very different than what Doge did. Secondly, we need a constitutional amendment that will limit how much debt as a percentage of the economy that we can take on. Only a constitutional amendment can bind current and future Congresses to be sane and sustainable with regard to our finances. And thirdly, we need a statutory fiscal commission that will engage the American people, the facts, the truth, the tough choices, help them understand the serious adverse consequences if we have a debt crisis, solicit their input, and make a package of recommendations that for an up or down vote in our Congress that will do several things: promote economic growth, significantly reduce projected spending, and increase revenues as compared to the projection. And all of these numbers, all these metrics need to be measured as a percentage of GDP, because that's what happens. You need to look at deficits, debt, revenues, expenses, interest as a percentage of GDP. That's the proper basis.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed, David M. Walker, the former Comptroller General in the US government and author of America in 2040. Really appreciate your time in joining us here today. We've really taken a whistle-stop tour geographically, historically, and economically. Thanks so much.
Happy to be with you, Susan. All the best.
Now that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Culleton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And please do subscribe to the show while you're there. It's also on radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. And the producer of Taking Stock is John Faraday. And on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. I look forward to chatting to you next week.